Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone. Welcome again to another episode of Living History. And like always, thank you very much for the feedback you've sent in from the recent episodes. We always love hearing from you, so please reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter are the two main ways you can contact us and let us know what's happening in your world. Let us know if you've got any ideas for upcoming podcasts. We love getting your feedback about ideas for podcasts. And this week we have yet another exciting and interesting episode, a little bit of a departure from the hardcore military history we've been doing lately, but I think you're really going to enjoy this one. It's a fascinating story that I didn't know very much about, and I think as Australians, we should say that none of us know enough about this story. We're talking about British atomic testing in the middle of the Australian desert in the 1950s, just an extraordinary chapter of our history. And here to tell us all about it is someone who's got a new book on the subject. It's Dr. Elizabeth Tynan. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us to talk about these atomic bomb tests.
Lovely to be here, Matt. Nice to meet you.
Now, you've got a new book out on the subject. You've already written a great book about the subject, but you've got yet another one out, which is here, The Secret of Emu Field. And I've got to say, I'm professing my ignorance, but a story I'd never heard of. And I think really that's the point, isn't it? I mean, I think as Australians, we would say we just don't know enough about this story. It's quite remarkable that it's fallen through the gaps of history.
I couldn't agree more. It's extraordinary. The subheading, of course, is Britain's Forgotten Atomic Tests in Australia. And it has really struck me as a researcher of atomic testing history in this country that these particular tests were so far under the radar. And they were certainly overshadowed by what was to come. They predated Maralinga by 3 years. But they were in many ways, and I make the argument in the book, in many ways more disruptive and more devastating to the people of the area than even Maralinga, and caused a great deal of hardship and harm to people in the area. So I think it's time we all knew the name Emu Field.
Well, set the scene for us. Let's look at the big picture. What were the British doing? Why were they even here? And how did they come to be setting off nuclear bombs in the middle of the South Australian desert?
It's the most interesting story, and it's a story of contingencies, I suppose, things that happen that cause ripples somewhere else. So we have to actually track back, and I'll just do this briefly, but track back to the very beginning of the Second World War, when much of the basic physics around the possibility of atomic weaponry was being developed and thought about and worked on in Britain. And that included a number of refugee physicists who had escaped Nazi Germany and had come to Britain for refuge and continued their work. And just as the war was beginning, physicists were starting to publish extraordinary ideas around the possibility of nuclear fission. And this led to certain people starting to think about the possibility of this physical phenomenon being turned into a weapon. There was a memorandum that was prepared by two refugee scientists who were working at Birmingham University that was very simple. It was a 3 or 4 page memo, but it set out the possibility of an atomic weapon. And that memo was conveyed to the very top of the British government, to the Prime Minister. And we believe that Mark Oliphant had a role. He was working over in the UK. The great Australian physicist Mark Oliphant was working in the UK at the time, that he had a role in making sure that people in the British government understood the implications of this. Fairly soon after that, the British embarked on what was to become the very first atomic weapons development and research organisation, and it became known as Tube Alloys, which was a deliberately enigmatic name that was meant to sound boring. It sounded like an industrial organisation of some kind, but within that they did, hiding in plain view in laboratories around the country, they did the basic work that proved that it was possible using uranium-235 to create a serviceable weapon. Then, of course, the war started. Publication, scientific publication, had to shut down because it became apparent that this information was also available to Nazi Germany. And ultimately, the ideas, the technology went over to America, where the Manhattan Project was created. Now, a carefully negotiated agreement between Britain and America, the Quebec Agreement, enabled a mission of British scientists and technologists to join the Manhattan Project. And it was led by a fellow called Professor William Penny. And within that group of British scientists, unknown to the authorities at the time, were some spies. These were physicists who had an ideological position that scientific knowledge, physics knowledge, should not be kept secret, that it should be shared, and that they believed that the Soviet Union, for example, who they were working for, had every right to this information. And of course, as we know, the Manhattan Project was successful. The bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. In 1946, the first of the British spies was uncovered, Ellen Nunn May. And that led directly to US legislation called the McMahon Act, which made it illegal for America to work with other countries on nuclear weapons development. And Britain was very wrong-footed by this. They believed that they would continue working with the Americans as they had done during the war in the Manhattan Project. They thought that that would just continue. And they were all set to go. William Penny, the great British physicist, mathematical physicist, very inventive brain. He was already working with them in the Pacific, but he had to be sent home. And the British then had a choice to make. Would they hope that America would eventually let them back in and in the meantime would protect them in the event of a nuclear war? Or would they go it alone? Would they build their own bomb? And in January of 1947, the decision was made by a secret committee of cabinet that they would go it alone. But that created a whole range of complications. First of all, this was a nation, as you would well know, that was devastated by war. It was broke. It had no money. It had very few resources. Nuclear weaponry is very expensive. It requires large quantities of uranium oxide. They had very little in the way of resources, certainly little in the way of money. And they also, even though they'd been part of the Manhattan Project, they did not have sufficient knowledge within the British mission scientists to create a bomb, because the Americans had kept them away from some of the crucial parts of the story. So it was a fairly, I suppose Sir Humphrey would say, a courageous decision to proceed with their own nuclear bomb. But at the time, there was a certain amount of patriotism associated with that. Ernest Bevin, the foreign minister, famously said, "We have to have this bomb and it has to have a Union Jack on it." So it was then up to people like William Penny and others to decide how they were going to make this happen. They cast around for places to test. They decided early that they could not be testing these weapons in their own territory. They initially thought maybe Scotland and maybe one or two other places might be suitable, physically suitable, but that was held down in Parliament and legislation was enacted that made it illegal to test fission weapons on British territory. So they had a whole former empire to look at. They went looking. They initially wanted to work in Canada to test weapons, particularly at a place called Churchill, a very cold part of Canada. The Canadians, who had been heavily involved in the Manhattan Project themselves, knew what was at stake here, and they ultimately said no because they understood what the damage would be. They tried several other places. They looked all through the Caribbean, all through Africa, many, many places, and ultimately they settled on Australia, rather reluctantly, I have to say. And the very first British atomic weapons test was held actually off the coast of Western Australia in Montebello Islands in October 1952. And that was a maritime test that tested a weapon, the effects of a weapon, an atomic weapon detonated in the hull of a ship. And Britain, being a maritime nation, they wanted to understand how that would work. At that time, my understanding is that was the first time that sort of test had been carried out. Mind you, by now, thanks to the spies from the Manhattan Project, the Soviet Union had a nuclear weapon as well. So Britain therefore became the third country. Now, I mentioned the fact that they were broke and had few resources. Now, this is very important to understand what happened next. Emu Field is a direct result of the fact that they had little money and few resources, and they were in the process of changing their nuclear infrastructure as well. So they had the Windscale reactor, which you probably heard of, later became Sellafield, had a nasty accident in the mid-50s, but this was before then. But they were changing their infrastructure away from Windscale, which created weapons-grade plutonium for atomic weaponry. They were switching to a new reactor called Calder Hall, which was intended to be the first reactor in the world. Indeed, it was the first reactor in the world that made both weapons-grade plutonium and also fuel for civilian electricity. And because of the change in the infrastructure, it meant that the output of nuclear fuel was going to be somewhat different to what they'd been used to from Windscale. It was going to have a higher proportion of a particular isotope of plutonium. So the fuel of choice for nuclear weapons, fission weapons, is plutonium-239, but the fuel coming out of Calder Hall was going to have a higher proportion of plutonium-240. They wanted to test whether that would make the weapon unstable. And so they needed to do this in utmost secrecy. And the fact that they had to eke out as much fuel from their uranium as they could meant that this increased the possibility of having too much plutonium-240 in their fuel. So they also wanted a terrestrial test site because they were testing weapons that ultimately would be deployed to the Royal Air Force, to the new V bombers that were coming off the production line later in the 50s. So they sought, with the help of the Australian surveyor, Len Bedell, they sought to find an extremely remote location within the Woomera prohibited area. And as you no doubt know, the British had been testing rocket technology at Woomera since about 1947. So there was already a large chunk of South Australia that had been given over to Britain weapons testing. So they looked at the far reaches of the Woomera prohibited area, and Len Bedell located a clay pan, which was about 1.6 kilometres long and was flat and could land military aircraft. And that was the key to choosing that particular area. It was a very difficult location, though, because they had no road access. The clay pan, yes, you could land aircraft there, but in wet weather or in difficult conditions, it became very dangerous to do so. And ultimately, they built an all-weather strip alongside the clay pan because they had a huge volume of traffic coming into Emu as soon as they located it on the map. So that's how it all started. They They had decided on emu even before the hurricane test in 1952 at Montebello, but then they had to make it happen very, very quickly after that.
So how many weapons did they detonate at Emu Field during the time that they were using it?
They detonated two full-scale fission weapons and then five minor trials, as they were known, of in a series called Kittens, which sounds all very cuddly, but it certainly wasn't. These were initiated trials that were very toxic and nasty. So five Kittens trials, but the full-scale weapons were the Totem series. So there was Totem 1 and Totem 2 that were both detonated in October of 1953, 12 days apart. And in particular, Totem 1 did a huge amount of damage, lasting damage. They both, though, created huge fallout that came as far as Townsville, where I'm sitting today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's just extraordinary, the idea that in the middle of continental Australia, they would be setting off nuclear weapons. And reading about it in your book, it seemed an extraordinary combination of really good science, which was required to produce the weapons and the testing site, but then a lot of guesswork, a lot of unknowns. A lot of it seemed quite slapdash, particularly their knowledge about how the weather would affect fallout and the nature of the explosion that they were about to create. Is that a fair assessment of what was going on there?
Spot on, Matt. That's absolutely true. They had very, very little baseline knowledge. They had not done fallout studies to any great extent from the hurricane trial the year before. They knew virtually nothing about fallout, and I've got to say, they didn't really care very much about it. They were interested, particularly William Penny, who was the designer of the weapon. He was most interested in the performance of the weapon, particularly given the lesser nature of the fuel that they were using. They wanted to see whether they could quickly get to 50 fission weapons for deployment to the Royal Air Force using the resources that they had. So they were up against a certain amount of political pressure and time pressure. They were very mindful of the fact that the Americans and the Soviet Union were way ahead of them. In fact, both those two countries had already started preparing to test hydrogen bombs, fusion weapons. So they were well ahead. Britain felt that it was trying to catch up. Safety was not a priority, and lack of knowledge was not an impediment to the British test authorities. They forged ahead. In fact, the Emu Field site was created in next to no time, with virtually no planning and indeed with no warning to the people who lived in that area and who would become, would be in the path of the toxins, particularly from Totem 1 on the 15th of October 1953.
Well, that's the most disgraceful part of the story, is the effect on local people. Tell us a little bit about who was living in the area and what effect these blasts had on them.
Emu Field itself is a fairly small area, and there were no permanent habitations precisely in that area. But as you know, the toxins from nuclear weapons spread far and wide. There were many, many Aboriginal people living in the vicinity. I'm thinking now particularly about between 150 and 200 kilometres to the northeast of Emu Field were stations and other settlements where a lot of Aboriginal people lived around Wallatina, Minterbee, Granite Downs, that kind of area. And also off to the northwest, there was a mission called Ernabella, where many, many Aboriginal people lived. Also, October was the hunting season, and many Aboriginal people were on the move at that time. They were hunting dingo pups, and they moved freely between water holes. So we know that there are lots of people both living within range of the toxins, but also walking around the area hunting. So, but of course, there was little known about Aboriginal people at that time. They were not counted in the census. That did not happen until a referendum in the 1960s. They had little in the way of political representation. No data were collected on births and deaths or on their health. And so in this information vacuum, suddenly the British plonked down in the middle of their country with a highly dangerous set of experiments that was bound to cause harm, possibly death, and we believe that it did cause death to people and long-lasting harm. And very little concern. The British were incurious. They didn't seem at all troubled by the fact that this was the homeland of a marginalised people in this country. So they just went ahead. The only safety measure, and this was not one that was instigated by the British, but it was one instigated by the Australian government, was the deployment of a so-called native patrol officer, a single person, one person, Walter McDougall, to cover 100,000 square kilometres to try and warn people about the risks and to get them to stay away from this part of the country. Now, that's a doomed venture. And it's made more so by the fact that Walter McDougall, who was a genuinely good person and a heroic person in this story, but he knew virtually nothing himself about atomic weapons. He had no background knowledge about it. He could only try to explain the risks in terms that people in that part of the country might understand. And it was very hard for him to do that. He certainly did his best, and no doubt he did save lives. However, even people at Wallatina, 170 kilometres away, actually were the worst affected, not necessarily people who are closer. So because of a phenomenon that is associated with Totem One called the Black Mist, which was a very strange phenomenon, although not unheard of in nuclear testing or in use of nuclear weapons. We know after Hiroshima there were reports of a black rain, which seem rather similar. The black mist rolled over Aboriginal communities about 5 hours after the detonation on the 15th of October. It was a greasy, black, strange miasma that sort of settled on the buildings and the trees. And they saw it coming. You know, the parents were urging their children to dig holes for themselves to get under, to shelter from it. People were covered in this sticky material. Now, these are people who are very much in tune with their environment. They understood dust storms and, you know, fogs and things like that. They had never seen anything like this before. It was a toxic and very strange, unnatural mist that descended upon them. We still don't know precisely what was in it. There's some suggestion that it might have been a nasty substance called cobalt-60 that was a product from the fission reaction mixing with the cobalt-59 in the towers themselves, that might have been a product of the reaction, and that is a particularly nasty substance. We don't know for sure, though, exactly what it is, because it was not investigated at the time. It was only later, very courageous people, most especially Yami Lester, who was a child at the time, who was at Wallatina, and he later became an activist and someone who fought very hard to get investigations into this. And he was one of the people who was responsible for prompting the Royal Commission that was held in the mid-1980s to investigate what happened. But it was a particularly nasty event that almost certainly killed people, although once again, we do not have baseline data about of health statistics from that area. But anecdotal evidence is overwhelming, and a lot of that evidence was presented at the Royal Commission.
Well, you mentioned the Royal Commission, Liz, which sounds, given the scale of the disaster that occurred there, it sounds like a Royal Commission was very much in order. Was anyone ever held to account in either Britain or Australia for this? Because the other part of the story that seemed remarkable to me was the Australian authorities seemed quite complicit in this whole thing. Australia seemed perfectly happy for Britain to come over and detonate untested nuclear weapons on our soil. So was anyone ever held to account for everything that was going on here?
Not really. And by then, of course, the government responsible, which was the Menzies government, had long gone. The Menzies government, Robert Menzies came to power in 1949, which and only a year or so before the British first approached Australia. So they first approached Australia in September of 1950 for permission to test at Montebello. And Menzies at that point took the call from Clement Attlee, who was the then British Prime Minister, and agreed immediately without taking the matter to Cabinet. So that's a well-established fact that the very first test anyway was not something presented to Cabinet. It was certainly not presented to the Australian people either. And in fact, only three people knew, Menzies and two of his ministers knew about the British test for a very long time before anyone else knew. And the whole deal was stitched up very casually indeed. It was not just Menzies being the usual Anglophile, though. He had some ulterior motives. He, in the wake of the Second World War, he was looking to shore up Australian defences by cooperating with one of its most important allies. Also, perhaps even more importantly, not long before, Australia had discovered large deposits of uranium, and Britain really wanted those deposits of uranium. Mind you, so did America, and there did ensue a tussle between Britain and America to get hold of Australian uranium. But Robert Menzies saw dollars coming from our mineral resources there, and so he was pursuing that, but he was also very much pursuing the possibility of Australia becoming a nuclear nation as well, and gaining the knowledge by allowing Britain to test on Australian territory. Our scientists and technologists would be let in on the knowledge, and we would create, if not our own weapons, but at least our own nuclear power, and we would potentially buy weapons from Britain. He was perhaps not asking enough questions at that point, because at no point did the British pass any secrets about atomic weaponry to Australia at any point. Not a single. In fact, Ernest Titterton, the ostensibly Australian physicist who, for part of the time anyway, managed the Australian Weapons Test Safety Committee, which was supposed to provide safety advice to the Australian government on the tests. He was actually an English physicist, part of the Manhattan Project, very much English in his loyalties. He cut off a lot of the information flow between Britain and Australia, as was uncovered during the Royal Commission. So, in fact, Australia never got the nuclear knowledge that it was seeking by being cooperative with Britain. It did do deals on uranium, however, but as you know, uranium was never the economic bonanza that it was supposed to be when, you know, around the time of Emu Field, it was considered to be a new gold rush, but that never actually came to pass. But this was part of the thinking of Robert Menzies and why he was eager to say yes to these tests. Mind you, he was completely aware of the risks and he was briefed on the risks. I have seen briefing documents on these risks and they're really sobering documents. But he said yes anyway, and he showed very little interest in the dangers that were posed, and he spent quite a bit of time in the media assuring everyone it was all perfectly safe.
Well, it's an extraordinary story, Liz, and, you know, a shameful chapter of our history, and one that should absolutely be better known. I mean, that's why the book is called The Secret of Emu Field, because the tests were so covered up, and indeed today are still virtually unknown. It's a wonderful story, and thank you for the hard work you've done on it and for bringing this story to us. The book is out now, and I recommend everyone go out and get it and read a copy of this, because it's an extraordinary story and one that we need to know more about. But I look forward to reading the next book as well, Liz. It's a wonderful chapter of history, and thank you for exploring it. And thank you for coming on the show to discuss it with us.
A great pleasure, Matt. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.